Interferometers are a big topic here on the channel. It's possible to say that we're all a little obsessed with this idea that you can combine the light from multiple telescopes and create a virtual telescope equal to the separation between those telescopes. Now, we've seen this work with the Event Horizon Telescope and the radio waves, and there are even interferometers that work in other wavelengths, including infrared. But there is an interferometer that works in visible light, and this is the Chara Array, which has been operating for about 20 years at Mount Wilson Observatory, just outside of Los Angeles. I've been very curious about this interferometer because it is visible light. It is one of the more complicated ways you can try to create a virtual telescope. And yet this has given us incredible views of rotating stars, calculating the separations between binary stars. It has incredible strength, and it also has some limitations. My guest today is Dr. Nick Scott. He is a telescope system scientist for the Chara Array, which is funded by Georgia State University and the National Science Foundation. And Nick works on instrument design in helping to upgrade and improve the Chara Array. Six individual 1 meter telescopes acting as if they are a telescope 300 meters across, the biggest visible light telescope on the planet. And they're adding even more upgrades. They've got a mobile telescope that they can move around, potentially up to 1,000 meters away, to add to the array to increase its resolution. So if you're interested in interferometers, and I know you are, then enjoy this conversation with Nick Scott. Nick, can you give me a sort of, I guess, a virtual mental tour of the Chara Array? Where is it located and how is it situated?
Sure. It's a really unique location in that it's on Mount Wilson Observatory, which is a historic observatory outside of Los Angeles. So you don't often have such a large observatory right next to a major metropolitan area. It's at 5,700 feet. It's about 40-minute to an hour drive from the outskirts of LA. We're surrounded by some of the most historic telescopes in the world. So the 60-inch telescope, the 100-inch Hooker telescope, this is the place where Hubble and Shapley worked and discovered that the universe was expanding. And then within that historic observatory, we have the Chara Array. And so we've got six 1 meter telescopes, but they're spread out across the mountain in a Y shape. And they go from kind of edges of the cliff to edge of a cliff to a place where we could go a little further in the southwest and east directions. And on each one of those arms, there's two of these telescopes. And it's in what's called a non-redundant configuration so that the distances between them are all different. And we do that for interferometric reasons. And then there's vacuum pipes between. So these pipes are about this big around that lead between the bottoms of each of these telescopes. Some of them are on towers. Some of them are at ground level. A couple are underground. And they all go into this long beam combining lab. And this lab is this long rectangular building, and the pipes all have mirrors inside. They're all in vacuum because we're sending light along the ground, and that's where the worst seeing is, so the worst turbulence. So we evacuate those tubes. And eventually we get those pipes all lined up in a straight line going down that optical path length compensation facility. And then they come out of the light comes out of a periscope. And then we have these long delay lines. So we have rails with these motorized carts on them. Were built by JPL, and there's mirrors on them. And it's basically like an optical trombone. So while we're observing, right, if you use a telescope, it's a big clock. You have to compensate for the Earth rotating. Well, with interferometry, we have to also compensate for the path difference that the light takes. The only way to get interference is if the light takes the exact same path, or at least the same distance path, through all the telescopes. And so based on where we're looking, if we're looking to the east, the light's going to hit that telescope first. We need to slow down that light. We can't physically slow down the light, so instead we give it more distance to travel. And so the longest separation is between this S1 and E1 telescopes on different sides of the mountain, and that's 331 meters. And with an interferometer, it's not the size of your telescope that determines the small details you can see, it's the separation. So that 331 meters is as if we have the same angular resolution as if the whole mountaintop is one big mirror.
Right, right. I hadn't even thought of some of these things. So the fact that you're looking at an object that is to the right or to the west or to the east, uh-huh, or whatever, that the amount of time it takes for the light, for that I guess, for that same wavefront to enter the same, all of the different telescopes, you are now sort of off that resolution and you need to compensate the distance between the telescopes minutely.
You're out of track it. You're in an entirely different thing and you're not going to get any, you know, we call them
right.
That's the bands of light and dark. It's a Michelson interferometer, which goes all the way back to like Young's double slit experiment. So we were looking at bands of light and dark. And if you do that in enough different ways, you can build up an image of your object and you can measure things like the diameter of a star directly.
Right, right. And so what is this process? So the sort of the tuning process of you to bring those telescopes back into alignment, how is it done sort of physically by an operator?
By the operator?
Or by the computer that, you know, that does it, whatever.
There's many different stages, right? We've got, just for the operation during the night, if everything is already aligned and running, the light goes through the telescopes. We have adaptive optic systems at the telescope. So we have a deformable mirror and that helps make up for some of the atmosphere wonder. The light then goes all the way through into the lab. So no one's in the telescope. There's one operator running the whole thing at night, usually one operator, one scientist. There's lots of alignments we do during the day to keep this all running. The light goes through all these mirrors. It goes through what's called POPs, it's short for pipes of pan, because we have fixed segments of delay based on where we put certain mirrors for chunks of the sky. And then the active delay, once it comes out into open air in the lab, the cart rolls along and it can move up to 10 centimeters a second. So it can book it like pretty fast. Typically it's rolling slower. There's a motor cart, which is what's driving it. It's not physically connected to the optics cart. It's what's on a voice coil. So like a speaker, so that there's not vibration transmitted, because if you have ever looked into interferometry, vibration kills you. You're talking about, you have to get it to a fraction of the wavelength of the light you're looking at over the course of hundreds of meters. So any slight vibration, someone walking by the lab, a car driving by, will mess this up. People often ask if we detect, how do earthquakes affect us? And I've been observing before and you'll see the fringes just disappear. And then like, what was that? And you see, oh, it was a 3 on the Richter scale,
right,
dozens of miles away. And then they come back. So light goes through this path. On that cart, motion of the cart is the first order correction after the fixed delay. The primary mirror on the cart is on another voice coil. And it has an eddy current sensor, so it can detect exactly where it is fairly well. And then it also, it goes off a cat's eye reflector. So it's a parabola. It's a little mini telescope, basically. So that parabola, the main mirror can be adjusted. And then there's a piezo stack. So you can do really fine correction of distance. And that's where the very, fine tuning of the optical path happens. And that reflects off the cat's eye and then it goes down. And then we have a whole optical switch yard. And then it's about getting which telescope to which instrument. At the same time, we have a metrology laser that bounces off the cart so that we can measure to within a fraction of a micron, down to tens of nanometers or so or less, of where the cart is at any given time. So it's tracking the whole time. And all of that is, we have systems built in of lots of computing, lots of mechanics, lots of electronics, all having to work perfectly together to get that to work. And then once it goes to an instrument, we have multiple different instruments that, based on what science you're doing. And it may be open air and they combine at the, in the open air and then go into a camera and get detected. Or more common now is going into optical fibers or into integrated optic chips and then going to the detector.
And now I realize it's probably even more complicated than I'd originally, whether the object you're looking at is to the west, it's moving in the sky. And so the whole apparatus is compensating in real time as the distance of the light is changing as it approaches zenith and goes the other way. You're having to just move this entire the telescopes are turning, and then the mirrors that are bouncing, the distance between the telescopes is slowly adapting to keep this thing being an interferometer.
Yes. It's a massive amount of work. And it's analogous to, if you've ever made a pointing model for a telescope, to give you your telescope's never going to point perfectly right until you can, build up a catalog of stars and get your pointing very well. Well, we have the same thing. We have a baseline solution. So we have very precisely, the distances to the telescopes. We're in, fractions of a millimeter or many microns. We can actually measure, we have an annual meeting and we go through, you know, how the array is doing and lots of different details. How the mountain is moving or how the telescopes are changing, or we also have to take mirrors out, recoat them every so often. So then the entire beam chain, you're looking at like 20 reflections before you ever get near a camera, which is why we look at bright targets. We have to take out all those mirrors, recoat them, and then replace them and align them all. So alignment is a big task here.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing. All right. So let's talk about the kinds of targets, the kinds of observations, and sort of, you know, as I explained interferometers to my audience, it's all about, as you said, the separation of the mirrors that gives you the resolution, but the sort of the sensitivity comes from just the total surface area of your mirrors. And so if you've got 6 1-meter mirrors, that is a relatively small telescope compared to other giant astronomical observatories. And so what is the sort of, what are the best targets for you to point the CHERA array at?
Sure. So the trade-off, like CHERA stands for Center for High Angular Resolution Astronomy. Like, we care about the resolution. There are other places you can go much more sensitive, go deep. That's looking in you know, other galaxies and these, you know, deep field images. We, you know, started out with binary stars, orbits of stars, diameters of stars. So it's kind of an evolution. The guy that kind of got the CHERA array rolling, my advisor, Hal McAllister, started in speckle interferometry, and it built some speckle instruments. And that's where you use a single telescope to do interferometry. With the Michelson type, what we can do is fundamental astrophysics. So really, it's the basis of everything in stellar astrophysics is stellar models, understanding how stars form, now looking at how like possible planet forming regions are. So like young stellar objects. Now we've moved on from just orbits and complex orbits and diameters to imaging stars themselves. So a lot of stars, you know, there's a huge range in size of stars compared to the sun. It always usually shocks people when you show them that range. You know, the sun has spots on it, but those spots are, you know, about the size of Earth on projected onto the sun. With some of these stars, it's 20 or 40% of the area, maybe a spot, and we can track their rotation. We have movies, Rachel Rodenbacher has done some incredible research where, looking at, imaging these spots on these stars and you see them rotate and how they're changing with time. And that feeds straight into the theorists. You know, there's always this kind of interleaving in astronomy between the observationalist and the theorists. And, you know, you can come up with many models, but you need to have these particular measurements to be able to eliminate some of those models or pin that down. So that's where observation comes in. And so we get a lot of that. The orbits are the only way you can really tell the mass of a star directly. You know, it's very simple, gravitational, relatively simple. That if you have two objects orbiting in space, that they have you can tell what their mass ratio is and then get a physical mass. So that's why we weigh the stars. Other things are disks around stars. So now we're doing more imaging, because if you just have two telescopes, you have one baseline, you can measure diameter and that's it. When you have three, you can get what's called a closure phase, and you can start to see if something is circularly symmetric or not. And when you start getting more and more, and what's nice is it goes up by the combination. So if you have six telescopes, we actually have 15 baselines between them. So if you drew the lines all between, you know, it's n times n minus 1 over 2. So when you add a telescope, it's more like an exponential increase in your imaging ability. That was actually one of the reasons we got a sixth telescope built when the array was first constructed. And imaging is really paying off. Most of our nights observing now are with these six beam interferometers that can do imaging. We have the newest one is called Spica, and it works in R band. So we're going all the way into stuff you can see with your eyes. And Merc-X and Mystic work in H and K band. And we've designed the array in such a way that you could do simultaneous imaging with all of these. So all these beam combiners work together.
Now, the kinds of targets that you would be looking at, I mean, what is sort of like the magnitude? Because like, could I go outside and look at with my own eyes in dark skies on the
easily mountain? Everything you can see by eye, we can do. Your eye goes down like 6 magnitude. If you're perfect. We can get down to about ninth magnitude. So we have one beam combiner that's one of our new ones called Simrail. And it's an upgrade of the first beam combiner we ever made. So the nice thing in how Georgia State got around getting the array built is kind of incredible. Of part funding from GSU, part funding from National Science Foundation, one telescope paid for by the Keck Foundation, and GSU paid and built one beam combiner. So we had one instrument. It was Chara Classic. It was a very sensitive, just open air, going into a Dewar, into an infrared camera, two beam combiner. And what we did is made a consortium. The array is unlike most facilities and all, unlike I think every other interferometer, the few that there are, in that it's a complete collaboration. We have a consortium of multiple universities, multiple groups. You can propose, hey, I want to try this out and come test it here. If we can make it work, we will try that. You know, if it doesn't interfere with observations. So University of Michigan built the Merck-X and Mystic imaging combiners, partnered with the Côte d'Azur in France, as well as the Paris Observatory. So we have two groups from France, the Australian National University and University of Sydney. So it's kind of Australia, France, and the US are kind of the main players in interferometry. Even now, Kyoto Sengo University is using Simrail to do non-stellar objects, to look at measuring the diameter of NAGN, an active galactic nuclei. And that's one of our big drivers for getting more sensitivity.
Right. I mean, these things are big and interesting, but faint compared to the bright stars.
Yeah, we can do the nearest, you know, NGC 4151. But if you look at the number of targets, if you get them, you know, it's nonlinear. You gain a magnitude, you get a lot more targets. Mm. So that's kind of the future I see is wanting to upgrade the array. And the array is 20 years since our first science paper. First fringes were in 2001. So I'm the telescope system scientist. I do a lot of work on the hardware, on the telescopes, and the alignment. We all are a big Venn diagram of everyone works on everything. The thing that is a challenge is that we're not limited right now by technology. We're not limited by the theory. We are limited by resources. We could really be doing incredible things. So we have a project that's funded called CMAP. It's the Charleston Michelson Array Pathfinder. And this is part of this vision for the next stage of the Char Array would be this Michelson Array. And that would be, we're moving and testing using optical fibers to connect the telescopes instead of the vacuum tubes. Because it becomes cost prohibitive to have a giant vacuum tube going across mountains. You know, when you want to do like a kilometer baseline, that's not going to really be feasible. So we're looking at different ways for beam transport. So we have this mobile telescope. We can double our current maximum baseline eventually with and doing fringes through the optical fibers. But that fiber always has its own challenge.
Yeah. So can you talk about that mobile version of the, because this is new, right?
Yeah, this is new. So our current telescopes, the six original telescopes, were are more traditional. Like they were custom designed. They were, you know, designed in Tucson and built on site here by SeaWest, and they're a very rigid, very custom one-off design. Technology's, you know, evolved in 20 years. Now you can cut a check and you can buy a 1 meter very nice telescope. So we bought a plane wave 1 meter telescope, and they're getting into like CNC milling their mirrors. And they're incredibly lightweight. So their mirror is like a third of the weight of one of our primary mirrors, but still just as good. And they go carbon fiber truss, you know, really nice technology development. So what we did is we bought a plane wave 1 meter and we built a custom enclosure around it and put it on a trailer and then have a hookups and a smaller version of our adaptive optics on it. And it is entirely for fiber feeding. It doesn't go into the vacuum pipes. It still can connect to the lab, but we've trenched across the mountain. We've laid fibers and we inject light into those fibers. And they can combine then with all the other telescopes in the lab.
Wow. And so that process of bringing the images in from the mobile telescope, has that been effective?
We are very soon expecting our first on-sky fringes. We've gotten lab fringes through the full run of fiber. The weather and other technical issues have not cooperated recently. It's been a little hectic in California recently as far as weather and climate. But we expect it should be. It's been done in the past that there's been, you know, interferometry through fibers. There was originally plans on Mauna Kea to connect all of the big telescopes by fiber. The Keck interferometer was running for a while of connecting the two big Keck telescopes by an interferometer. So it's, you know, there's technological hurdles, but also a lot of those challenges we're looking at using integrated optics and partnering with optical engineers to make it go smoother than it has in the past. You know, one of the big issues is dispersion through the fiber, you know, because the fibers have different strains on them, and that's going to affect, you know, you have all sorts of things that can reduce the contrast of your fringes.
And I mean, it's so difficult to just align the images from these emplaced telescopes that you know very, very well, to just have one on a truck that you're driving around and then you stop and then have it join this network. I mean, wind blowing on the truck, the air pressure changing a little bit, a bird landing on one part of the, like, all of this has got to have an effect.
Yeah. So I actually designed the enclosure so that it, the entire telescope and its pier is the telescope and its pier is isolated from the truck and from the dome. And so there's no vibration transmitted. It has, a huge concrete pad and the concrete pier below ground. So we basically, in the course of an hour or two, you know, it transitions from a truck into a fixed telescope.
Right. Wow. And so what is the farthest distance you could take this truck from the rest of the array?
We are currently funded. We have it now. We wanted to add a new short baseline. So not just the longest is good, but having these shorter baselines. So we have a roughly 17 meter baseline added in a triangle. And we have another position ready that's at about 550 meters. So almost doubling our current resolution. And just for scale for people, like, our current resolution with the 331 meters is equivalent to reading newsprint in New York City from Los Angeles. That's the kind of details of these angular scales.
If it was very, very bright newsprint.
If it was very bright and very high contrast, yes.
Yeah.
That's the catch. So we have this, our second site is prepared and ready, and that's where we will move into testing once we finish with doing the initial test at the 17 meter. But we've also identified a potential third site, which is actually off of the observatory grounds on the other side of the mountain where the Los Angeles Basin TV antennas are. There's a site that would give us an 1,100 meter baseline.
Wow.
And that would, you know, it'd be absolutely groundbreaking.
Yeah, then it's on the moon. You're reading that newspaper.
At that point, we're reading the period on the manual that was left behind, like the dot at the end of the sentence on the manual left on the moon by the astronauts.
Right. As long as it was as bright as a star.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So I think this gives people like a real sense of the array as it currently stands. Uh-huh. And so now I want to sort of move into just interferometry in general, because it is easily one of the most popular topics on my channel. And I've had to become a sort of amateur expert in this, in the limitations of interferometry. So I can at least, sort of kill the dreams of the people who ask
these questions. Don't ask me to go through Fourier equations on the blackboard on the spot.
Yeah. And so I guess what people always want to know is, why can't we just make ad hoc interferometers out of the enthusiasm and volunteer efforts of people around the world with their telescopes or with Starlink satellites that are in space? Or why can't the world's observatories come together to create an interferometer like we saw with the Event Horizon telescope?
Sure. Well, the difference is the wavelength. It's kind of a regime change. When you get from radio and get shorter and shorter wavelength, you move from what's heterodyne interferometry, where you have the separate recording of the wavefront and encoding, time encoding and all that. When you get into the optical regime or the near infrared regime, you're still limited that you have to physically combine the light. There's not a way to encode because of quantum effects and you know, to operate fast enough, you're not catching enough signal for it to ever show up over the noise. So you kind of get this limitation of physics that you have to physically bring the light together. Until there's a couple ideas on doing like quantum interferometry.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to bring that up later on, but yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But for now, you have to have the wavefront travel that entire path. And the problem is that Like with our telescopes, we make sure that not only do they have the exact same number of reflections, the same angle of reflections, even though they're in different spots, because you have to maintain the polarization. So if you have a difference in polarization, you're going to lose your fringes as well. The biggest, like in going to the history of interferometry, like this was the same site where the first interferometer, the Michelson interferometer, was built for stellar interferometer, the 20-foot. And it was basically outriggers for the 100-inch telescope to be able to measure the diameter of Betelgeuse in around 1920. After that, they built the 50-foot interferometer. And that one never really worked well because mechanical limitations of the day. You just can't build a truss stiff enough that you can make it rigid enough that flexing and all that, that you're getting a signal. And what we do is this many stages of correction, like I said, with the carts and with the mirrors, is moving them, is that we're constantly doing active corrections for the path length. And that's where the challenge gets. If you wanted to, you know, hook up with your neighborhood and set up all your backyard telescopes and run them, one, how are you going to get all the angles the same, all the same mirrors? How are you going to do it? Vibration kills you. That's just, different optical quality. There are many ways to not get fringes. Everything has to be absolutely perfect. That's part of what I like about astronomy, is you've got to have optics, electronics, mechanics, everything working perfectly.
To the 100 nanometers or so. Like, what is the...
There are tens of nanometers. You're in the
right. Fractions of tens of nanometers.
Wavelength you're measuring.
Yeah.
So like jitter, one of the issues, is we have these moving parts, and every moving part has some jitter and backlash, and all of these mirrors are before the alignment all in motorized stages, and that means jitter and backlash and thermal effects. And we see, like right now the weather's just turned cold on the mountain for the first time of the season, so we went from 80 degrees down to 30 degrees, and so everything is moving all the time. All the distances between all the mirrors is changing all the time. It's just extraordinarily difficult.
Right. And so really, to go beyond what you have at 300 meters enters extraordinarily difficult terrain. Do you sort of imagine a limit? I'm sort of envisioning, like, you have a whole bunch of those trucks and you take them to the high altitude salt flats in Peru, drive them around and then park them and telescope them and then connect them together, Do you sort of envision where it just becomes impossible?
This is actually where a lot of, when I go to a conference recently, a couple conferences this year, where this is a main topic, like the VLTI, the other main interferometer in the Southern Hemisphere, they're looking at, what they could do if they had another telescope, another UT, another 8-meter telescope on another mountaintop. What could they do? And like I said, vacuum tubes are just cost prohibitive. It's a huge amount of infrastructure to build. Fiber is a possibility, but fiber has its own challenges. You don't get many losses over distance, but you add dispersion and stresses on the fiber. A tiny twist in the fiber that's different between one and the other is going to mess you up, unless you have to compensate for that or track it. One of the ways being looked at would be similar, kind of an offshoot of adaptive optics, of open air beam transmission, and then use adaptive optics at the ground level to clear it up. So you beam the light across, you have a beacon at the ground level or a laser at ground level and deformable mirrors to compensate for all the turbulence in the open air. But then, the atmosphere is much thicker. The nice thing with looking up is there's most of the distortion of the wavefront is happening way lower down because most of the atmosphere is pretty thin. But when you're going long distance over ground level, that's not really been tried much. So this is kind of the discussions among astronomers of what do we want to do in the next 10, 20, 30 years? Where do we focus? These are kind of the cost benefit analysis and pros and cons lists we're making.
But it feels to me like, I'm sort of envisioning, right? You're firing this laser. The laser is acting like a guide star, but you're going through the soup of the atmosphere. You're compensating your mirror. You are measuring the distance. These all sound like the holy grail to astronomers, mm-hmm. right? Like, yeah, would you like a telescope that has the light gathering capacity of 10 meter telescopes, but they're separated by 10 kilometers? Yes, please. Right? Of course they do. And so then, is it that people just go, it's just not possible. There's no way, it's infeasible. Let's not continue to investigate it. Or is it that, that we're sort of in the early stages of this even being feasible with the new technologies that have come online?
Well, I mean, there's a good white paper on this, what was called the PFI, the Planetary Formation Imager. And that was an idea of what would be our ideal, justified by the science, right? First, you list your science goals. Here's the things we want to know. Then you see, well, how do we build an instrument to do that? And it would be something like, 10 or a dozen 10-meter telescopes separated by kilometers, and then doing beam transport. And you can make some trade-offs, right? With an interferometric telescope, like our field of view is about a few arc seconds. So you don't need to worry about, like, if you're building something like the Rubin telescope where you're doing large field, you've got, if you've ever done any optics, you know that the edges of the field are the places where all your problems come up. If you're doing a narrow field of view, it gets a little easier. So there's ways you can bring the cost down that way. The tricky part is not just the telescopes, though, and the separation. That is arguably easy. The longer your separation, the more delay control you have to have. So like with our, if we expand to the kilometer baseline, that means our optical compensation lab needs to either get much longer, or we need to introduce more reflections and do more passes along the carts. So adding in more reflections, which lowers your sensitivity. So it's always you're stealing from one thing and gaining here. But as to, limitations, like I said, it's resource limited. If we had, in a different timeline where it's like, hey, yeah, let's do this Apollo type or even, smaller scale, like build a national observatory, a national facility, and do imaging of these things, like imaging exoplanets directly, it could be done. There are technological difficulties, but nothing that's a complete game stopper.
Mm-hmm. Is anyone else working on these larger arrays? I mean, anything in Europe, anything in China?
VLTI is the main one, right? VLTI is a very large telescope interferometer. They're looking at, potentially expanding in the future. So that's the main one. China.
Are they invisible or they're mainly in infrared, aren't they?
Mainly in infrared, yeah.
Yeah.
So like H and K band, I believe, and some longer. We do R band as well. So that gives you a resolution bump. Currently, there's Magdalena Ridge Observatory is another large interferometer. They just recently got their first fringes. And they've also had challenges over the years in getting up and running, but now we're very happy they've got fringes. But that's kind of it. There's not many interferometers. And
nothing in China.
Not in the optical that I know of. I know they've done a lot. They maybe looked at radio, but it's not something I've kept track of.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything either. So
Last I heard it was like they're working on big radio telescopes was a primary thing for them.
Now, the obvious application, the place where most of your problems go away is to go to space.
Mm-hmm.
Back at the turn of the century, the next big step after Kepler was going to be the terrestrial planet finder. And this was going to be probably a space-based interferometer where you had multiple telescopes flying in formation, combining their beams, giving you that high level of resolution. And I think as development of James Webb became more and more complicated, more difficult, they could see the costs were running up. They went, that's just going to, there's even more risk in the terrestrial planet finder. So 2011, they shut down that mission and we haven't heard from it since. Now there's other ideas. There's the Habitable Worlds Observatory. There's the LIFE mission. Is it time for a space-based interferometer?
There's a few options. There's also I've seen proposals for, early preliminary proposals for like an interferometer on the moon.
Yep.
Like Gerard Van Bell has been talking about this and then.
Yep. I interviewed him about that. Yeah.
I think part of it is a timing thing. Formation flying is incredibly risky and not well demonstrated yet. There are a lot of challenges if you make like something like SIM where it is a truss or a single large interferometer. Again, you still have problems of vibration and flexing. These are all things that could be, solved. One of the best ways to test this early on I saw was BETI, which was the balloon-based interferometer. Because then you're going to get the best of both. If you can test something while it being, space-like, but you can still bring it back down and correct things. Unfortunately, it had a mishap. We've got colleagues, I don't know if you've traced Michigan, John Monnier has looked at like formation flying of drones to test and to demonstrate as technological demonstrator that we could, before going to space, demonstrate that we could build an interferometer on flying drones. And if you can do it with that vibration, you're set.
Wow.
Yeah, there's a
like
lot
an
of
optical or even infrared interferometer flying on drones.
Yeah. Yep.
That's crazy. I hadn't even thought of that.
Yeah, it's a great idea. And he's had some funding to do that, you know, small project. What I think is, you know, it's an incredibly interferometry is well proven. It's a, you know, very promising technology. For a while, you know, in all our meetings, there was often people saying, you know, interferometry is inevitable. You know, you can't keep building bigger and bigger ground base. You run out of land. Look at the challenges for TMT, for sites. It's just not feasible to build, you know, a 100-meter telescope, single aperture, and then you still don't even have the resolution we have. So you've got to do something different. I'm a big fan of space and ground-based. I don't think you can do all of one or the other. They do entirely different jobs. And also, one of the things we've benefited from is the Char Array now is an entirely different animal than it was 10 years ago and then when it was built, because we can continually upgrade. We are constantly working on things, both for maintenance and upgrading as we replace things. So it's a living creature. And you can't do that in space. You got to do it perfect once, and that's all you get. It's great for that. You know, you have a very specific question you have to answer, and you go and do that, or you do a large survey of the whole sky, like something like TESS. But for ground-based, it's really a, you know, observatory is a huge endeavor and a resource, because you're training people, you're building new instruments, you're building new collaborations. It's often multinational. It's a great investment. When I started, you know, going to conferences and talking about, you know, hearing about interferometry and coming out of the Char Array, interferometry was around, but it was the same group of people. It wasn't very wide in the community, and it was kind of a black box. You did your thing, and there's some data reduction code, and if you weren't an interferometrist, you had no idea how it worked. Seeing now that, like, your audience is asking about interferometry is huge. It's just kind of, you know, skyrocketed in how popular it is, and I think it's become ripe. Now, when I go to any astronomy conference, they're regularly presenting results from Char, results from VLTI. It's not looked at as, I don't know if I trust it. It is very much like, well, the interferometry says this. These are, you know, we have HR diagram where all of the stars are precisely measured. You know, 700 stars to a very precise diameter on an HR diagram is hugely useful. Ashley Elliott at LSU has been working on that with Tabitha Poyajian. And so, like, it's definitely time. Again, it requires investment. And like you said, I think interferometry and the Char Array have been under the radar for a very long time. We've just kind of been here chugging along. But it's why I came to Georgia State, was I heard about the Char Array and it seemed like a cool place to work.
Yeah. 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 You said, like, you know, my audience is interested. I would describe them as obsessed.
Great.
And I think it's just because it, as you said, it feels inevitable. It feels like that's where the progress continues. And we can see that we have things like the extremely large telescope. You've got a 39-meter telescope, but that's really at the very limits of what you can build a ground-based telescope. And we don't even know if it's going to work. Our shortest
baseline is 34 meters. So our shortest baseline is already an ELT
solution. Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, people thought that maybe you could build a 100-meter telescope, and that project was canceled. And so, like, we go to space, and then we've seen the results from the Event Horizon Telescope, the incredible high resolution images of supermassive black holes. And you're looking at regions that are just ridiculously close, and yet there it is. So, and so it sort of feels like it will progress, and that funding will eventually find its way into, larger and larger interferometer, projects. I'd like to shift gears and chat with you about your experience as an instrument designer. How does this work? That, you know, like, what is the pipeline? Like, I'm an astronomer. I have an observation that I want to make, or I admit that I can't find an answer. And then how does that turn into an instrument and eventually, you know, something that can get me my answers?
Most, not all, instruments I've worked on or seen or interacted with are evolutionary, right? It's because the ideas, the concepts are pretty simple, right? You want to collect light, you want to look at, you know, either high resolution or look at this color or whatever. And then what's been changing, like for instance, I did my PhD on an instrument called FLUOR, the fiber-linked unit for optical combination. So it was a early fiber combiner that had previously been at a different interferometer at IOTA, and before that it was another. And so it's the instrument moved around and finally settled at Chara. And it was two fibers that bring light together and couple and then go into a camera. So no integrated optic, no chip in it. And eventually, you know, it degraded over time. It was, you know, almost 30 years old. The fibers themselves and the people that built them had retired, and no one, it was a kind of a lost art to make these, you know, fibers to this degree. And now I'm working on a project called Chariot, the Char Array Integrated Optic Testbed. So we had all the, you know, optics are like big Lego sets. You know, you've got all these chunks of metal and little mirror mounts and all that. They're perfectly reusable, right? You've got it perfectly right there. Let's just replace the parts and upgrade things like the camera, the stages, the things that move, get higher precision as the technology. So it kind of works leapfrogging with, we both develop new technologies and also work with what the current state of the art is and buy what off the shelf we can, you know, just depending on our needs. So the idea was, Fluor was built for focusing on high precision. So it's two beam, highest precision measures of diameters as possible. So it's not doing imaging. It was just looking at getting all the systemic errors down as possible and making a very stable instrument. Chariot evolves on that of first integrated optic on it, was to replicate in silica, what Fluor did. So instead of being this big bulky fibers with bends and couples, it's about this big. But then the idea is like, well, if you're already connectorizing for a fiber, let's make it a universal connectorizing thing. And then we can say anyone could you make a chip and then bring it here. So it's a test bed where optical engineering labs that have done no astronomy at all and have no astronomy experience can contact us and be like, hey, I want to test this on Sky. They could ship it to us. We could plug it in and they could get time on Sky where we already have all the mechanisms to shuttle light and deliver these delay compensated beams to any instrument. It could be a plug and play interferometer for groups that have never done on sky interferometry before. And, you know, going from the lab to on sky is, you always learn things.
And so, I mean, it sounds like that there's this entire stack of both software, hardware, as you say, mirrors, chips, fiber optic cables, all of this stuff. And yet the entire technology is advancing across the sort of field. And you can go, hey, there's a much better CCD now. We can swap out the one that's giving us 2 megabits and put in the one that gives us 16 megabits. And then we're going to get higher resolution and that improves it. And I think about, say, what happened with LIGO, where they had sort of built the entire thing. It was one of the most impressive machines that humanity ever made and made no detections.
Yep.
And so they had to go through it piece by piece and go, okay, if we develop this method of quantum squeezing, we're going to get a little bit more out of this thing. If we improve the mirrors, we change all of this. And then they made their detections. And then they were like, aha, now we're in the right direction. Now we swap out these bits for those bits. And now they're making a detection every week. Mm-hmm. Like we're swimming in black hole collisions at this point. But that's sort of like this incremental evolutionary process where the whole thing is just getting, you know, I think of sort of my computer, my PC, and I'm swapping out parts of the PC with a better motherboard, better RAM, whatever. But then comes along new paradigms. You know, I bought a new MacBook and it's using the M chips, right, by Apple. It's a totally different architecture.
Yeah.
Right. So when do you sort of think about how you could just like new tech stack, new architecture, sure, come at it from a different direction entirely?
Well, we have one of those going on now. We're about to have our, actually next week, I'm supporting the observing run for Brookhaven National Laboratory. So it's their second run coming to visit us. And they're looking at doing quantum teleportation of light between the telescopes. So bypassing the delay, you know, delay lines and compensation that we have and the way the beam chain we have, and directly through quantum entanglement, getting an interferometric detection at the, they still have the delay compensation, but basically cutting out the vacuum tube transport or fibers in that way. That would be a revolutionary rather than evolutionary step.
Right. And this is a, you know, this idea of quantum telescopes, quantum interferometry, this is something that I'm sort of starting to investigate and evaluate. I'm going to be interviewing people who are working on this is a possible direction for, say, the Habitable Worlds Observatory and other big telescopes. You know, this is a way that you can solve your coronagraph problems. This is a way you can solve, potential, as you know, interferometry problems. Like, it's a very interesting technology. Does it feel to you like this is going to pan out, or does it feel like, you know, new age quantum everything?
It is. I don't think it's too early to say. It's very preliminary, but they're encouraging results and it's worth investigating. It is not at a stage where it's going to surpass what we're already doing, but by, you know, it's kind of a, you know, our philosophy of let everything, take everything and let it see what sticks, works really well. It would be great if it works. It'll probably be like most things pan out of, it has its niche where this is the best, but there's everything is a trade-off. And that remains to be seen exactly where the, you know, maybe it's a sensitivity hit. Maybe there's some correlations that are challenging. Maybe, you know, don't know yet, but it's, we're at this stage. And that to me is the really fun part of science. And that's also why, like, funding undirect, like not goal driven research is something that gets dropped off very quickly. But that's where you get these, you know, huge revolutions. When you set out of like, okay, we're going to measure this thing, study it only, anything else is superfluous, and we cut all the funding for that. That's great. You did what you set out for, but what about the things that you don't know what you're going to find in the course of it? Or this is where technology gets developed. This is where new science gets discovered. So you kind of have to have both.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. You know, there was a document out of NASA a couple of years ago that I consider one of the most sort of influential pieces of writing that I've read from NASA, called Capabilities Driven Exploration. Uh-huh. And the gist is that right now it's always very much goal-based exploration. Let's land humans on Mars. Let's land humans on the moon. And with the capabilities driven side is like, let's just increase our overall space exploration capabilities, infrastructure. Let's be able to have propulsion that works for longer time periods, life support systems that can keep humans alive longer. And then we'll come up with obvious targets to be able to use this stuff in a very sort of natural way. And it feels like that's sort of that same idea, which is, as long as we're kind of progressing across all of these fronts and trying to work out what are the niches, the actual practical niches for this technology, then we'll figure out ways to bring it together. But then it could also just be you're wasting a lot of time working on a lot of stuff that's never going to pan out, and you never know in advance, right?
Well, it's kind of the beauty I love about our ending up having the array here at Mount Wilson is that was the formation of modern astronomy, was George Ellery Hale being like, give me money, I will build a bigger telescope, we will find things. And then immediately going, give me more money, I will build an even bigger telescope, we will find more things. And kept doing that. And that's how the 60 inch, the 100 inch, and eventually Palomar 200 inch, and then Mauna Kea. And that's never not paid off for us, not just in the findings, but also, especially looking at something like interferometry that's highly technical, highly specialized. You know, I go to an interferometry meeting and there's 50 people in the room for the world, you know, at that meeting. It's not a big field. Worldwide, there's maybe in the, you know, a few hundreds of people that really do this work. And so you got a concern of like, you're also not just developing a facility base, you know, for your country or for your collaboration of multiple countries, but also like a technological center for who's training the next generation of interferometrists, who's keeping this from becoming something that, you know, scatters away or there's brain drain. You know, this is, like I said, your audience is interested. It's incredibly interesting field. And it does seem like it's inevitable at some point, if we continue to progress and want to do astronomy, you have to go into interferometry.
So for people who are in my audience, who are maybe early on in their careers, they're either maybe getting their undergrad right now or considering if they want to go on to some kind of graduate work, what are some places they could go to participate in this sort of new revolution?
As far as like, if they want to go to grad school in astronomy?
Yeah. If they want to go to grad school, if they want to get their master's and sort of work on interferometry, where are some good schools?
I'm biased to Georgia State.
Of course.
I went to Georgia State because of their interferometry and getting to actually work at an interferometer. University of Michigan is another that's, you know, especially for instrumentation in interferometry. A lot in France, but it's really scattered. You really got to look at what you want to do. If you're instrumentation first, I think look at the facilities and talk to them and see. If you're science first and you have the science goal and aerofoundry would be good, then I always advocate for people, if you are already entering grad school and you know the type of research you want to do, find which professor you want to work under, who you want to study under, who you potentially want to be your advisor, and talk to them. It is really kind of a nostalgic kind of throwback that sometimes the best way is to email someone and in academia and especially in like astronomy, email and be like, hey, I read this paper you did and I'm interested in working with the group. Is there any space? That you don't know. I mean, that may make an impression. Yeah.
That's my method to find people to interview.
Yeah.
And it's shockingly effective.
That is my number one counter when people are conspiracy theorists is like, have you talked to a scientist before? Try getting us to shut up. You know,
yes.
If it's not a complete, you know, insane thing, we'll mostly respond. You know, yeah. Same with there's a paper, oh, it's behind a paywall. Oh, email the author and ask him for a copy.
Yes. That's also the journalist trick,
yep.
Which is that, you know, and a lot of the times I'm having to educate the scientists. They don't realize that they can give out copies of their paper.
Yeah.
You know, as part of the agreement with their journal. And so you can, you know, yeah, as you say, you can get your hands on this. You can start to educate yourself about the work that's being done in your field and you're making contacts and connections and providing value potentially to the astronomer. Cause I think, you know, people are actually reading their work. That's validating. Nick, what are you obsessed with right now?
Right now, keeping the array running and improving it everywhere. Like it is, working at an observatory is a very service oriented in a way. Like our day to day is mostly spent making sure that night observations will go well. And so it is like, my main focus is, like I said, the array, a lot of it was built 20 years ago. It's been incrementally upgraded, but you know, a lot of the stuff now it's changing so fast. Things that were custom built PCBs and custom, you know, EEPROMs all coded in assembly can be replaced by an Arduino and do it all in C code. So switching the array out to more modular components, more easily replace things, just to make it so it moves smoother and faster in every way. Because we've added so much complexity. It was never originally designed to have, you know, adaptive optics. And we have 12 adaptive optic systems all running simultaneously, 6 at the telescope and 6 in the lab. And that's just an insane amount of work. And we're always right at the edge, you know, whatever motor you have, you're always right at the edge of its backlash limit, right at the edge of where, you know, it's, if only it was twice as good, our life would be easier. We're never happy, you know, it's,
yeah, but that's got to be tricky that you're trying to balance just helping an astronomer make their night's observing run with trying to figure out and implement ways of improving the array without getting in the way of the astronomers that are trying to complete their observation runs.
Yep.
And in many cases, you know the part that needs to be upgraded or fixed, but it's going to take the whole thing offline for a couple of weeks while you implement it. And then that means people can't use the telescopes.
Yeah. And now with so much focus on imaging, we need all 6 telescopes. The earlier days of the array, it would be, you know, oh, we're going to use these 3 and these 2, and there's a telescope that's going to be not used for a few nights. We could do work on it. Now the demands on the array are very high, which is great. It's a good sign, but it means time for all these improvements and maintenance is a scheduling challenge. I spend a lot of time thinking about single point failures and where to replace those.
Yeah. Well, Nick, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. Good luck with the array and with the mobile addition to the array and then the future 1,000-kilometer space telescope made of 50 separate satellites orbiting in perfect formation and showing us the newspaper on an alien planet.
Yeah, I want a telescope on all the mountains in the San Gabriels, all connected by fibers. And also, people, if they're in the Los Angeles area, Mount Wilson is open to the public. People can come up. There's a couple.
Yeah, it's very accessible. Just don't stomp around too loudly.
As long as daytime.
At night.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Nick, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Nick Scott. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Barry Lake Roofing, Brian Bodie, Caredwin, Chuck Hawkins, Commander Bialog, Cy Nielsen, David Verbaff, David Giltina, David Matz, Evan Pro, Greg Feely, Hudson Moore, James Clark, Jeremy Mattern, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Marcel Smits, Michael Purcell, Monzo, OneStepForAnimals.org, Paul Robach, Rankaidu, Richard Williams, Sean Sargent, Stephen Fowler Munley, Team 49, Telescopes Canada, Vlad Chaplin, and Wolfgang Klotz, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all our patrons. All your support means the universe to us. Well, I'm really glad I was able to do this interview with Nick. He was able to answer a lot of my questions about the Char Array specifically, as well as just interferometers in general. And I know that this will not be the end of it, that we will continue to be obsessed collectively about interferometers, and we will hold in our hearts waiting for that day when a space-based interferometer finally flies and gives us some of those possible applications, but out in space. It's really surprising to me how small the field really is when you consider that this is sort of the inevitable future of astronomy, that you're really limited by the forces of gravity on how big of a telescope that you can make. Taking these things, separate them, building these larger baselines is the obvious next step. And yet we're not seeing a lot of these projects that are being developed around the world, but hopefully that'll change. I guess maybe that's my part, is to help encourage and get more outreach to ideas that are sort of the next stage in astronomy development. Now, for those of you who do live in Los Angeles, you know, you're probably familiar with the Wilson Observatory. I've been to LA. I know you can see the observatory from various parts in Los Angeles, but take a weekend, go up and check out the observatory. And now when you're there, focus on looking for the Chara Array and learning more about that, and tell them Fraser sent you. All right, we'll see you next time.